Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
I'm Kathy with a K.
And I'm Kathy with a C.
And this is Killer Destinations.
Today's destination is Birkenhead, England. Located along the west coast of England, the name is thought to mean headland overgrown with birch, which once grew in abundance in the area. The city is on the Wirral Peninsula, separated from Liverpool by the River Mersey. Birkenhead is often overshadowed by Liverpool, but has its own unique and interesting history. The very first public park in the city that was opened in 1847, Birkenhead Park, inspired the creation of the world-famous Central Park in New York. The park was visited by famous landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted, who took his inspiration back to the United States. Today, Birkenhead has plenty to offer visitors, including green space, independent music venues, and art galleries. But in 1986, Birkenhead residents were shocked to learn that a new kind of terror had breached their town.
The town of Birkenhead awoke on a sunny August morning in 1986 to horrifying news. To many, it shocked them to their core. In the early morning hours of August 2nd, a young woman named Diane Sindel was brutally murdered for seasoned police officers. It was one of the most heinous crimes they had ever seen. 21-year-old Diane was from the town of Seacombe in Wirral, which was just a couple of miles from where her body was found. Her family owned a well-known florist business. Diane was often seen driving around town in her blue Fiat van that she used to make deliveries for her family. But in 1986, Diane was recently engaged, and so she decided to take a second job so that she could save money for the wedding. So Diane got a job working part-time at a pub at the Wellington Hotel in order to bring in this extra money. On the night Diane Sindel was murdered, she was working at the pub and had gotten off work just before midnight. But she never made it home. However, her van was found in Birkenhead, which was about 3 miles from the Wellington Hotel where she worked, and the gas tank was empty. It was assumed that she had run out of gas and started walking to a 24-hour gas station because the road she was on, which was Borough Road, was a busy road and it was very well lit. Tragically, though, Diane's half-naked body was found a few hours later by a dog walker in an alleyway that was just off Borough Road.
Needless to say, the community was horrified because Diane was such a well-known person and very well-loved, always upbeat, like you said. Police immediately began looking into her death, and no suspects immediately rose to the surface. And they tried backtracking and interviewing people when she was last seen, what she was like when she was, you know, leaving the pub, all this kind of stuff. Anyway, no suspects were bubbling to the surface. So a few weeks after her murder, BBC's Crime Watch decided to reconstruct her last movements. And that we have seen this in many cases where they do this right in England. And they're doing it to try to tickle the memory of the public. They're looking for help.
And they usually have actors playing the people who are deceased or involved, you know, coworkers, whatnot.
Exactly.
And put them in the same clothing.
Right. And a taxi driver told Crime Watch that the night that she ran out of gas, he had seen a woman and a man arguing on the side of the road that she was on. And he said to the police, it was clear that they knew each other, but it was also clear that they were in a fight. No real description of the man came forward such that he could ever be identified. But the taxi driver thought it was odd and he took note of it. So the taxi driver saw this couple a little bit after midnight. And according to Crime Watch, sort of the next chronology of events was residents reporting to police that they heard screaming, which they believe was between 12:30 and 2 a.m. This fit into the scenario of what occurred during Diane's attack. When Diane was found, she had a fractured skull. She had facial lacerations and bruising. She had mutilated breasts, and she had injuries consistent with a sexual assault. It was horrific and violent, and she would have been screaming. And according to court records, she died from a brain hemorrhage, which the doctor believed was a result of blows to the head. But he also said that he believed she lived for a period of time after these injuries were inflicted.
And so, of course, Kath, understandably, everybody was running scared, but particularly women and girls. They were afraid to leave their house. They didn't have a suspect in the murder case, as Kathy said. They didn't want to be on the streets alone. They didn't want to be in the house alone. And so even their fathers and brothers and husbands and boyfriends and whatnot were telling them, okay, you stay in wherever I'm picking you up from until I'm at your front door. Like, don't even walk out the front door to come meet me at the curb if I'm picking you up. And so it was from school. It was from work. It was for anything else that they were doing.
To friends' houses.
Exactly.
Like, nobody was walking.
But Kath, the residents described Diane's murder as feeling different. That's what had everyone on edge, is that it was just different. I mean, obviously it was horrific, but what happened was, of course, as we said, Diane ran out of gas and left her car and started walking a busy, well-lit road to go find a 24-hour gas station. And so all of these women could see themselves in the same position. And so to them, it was like you pluck out a normal slice of life, and that's what got her killed through no fault of her own.
I've run out of gas. You probably have never.
I've never run out of gas.
Kathy's like paranoid, and she keeps always like above halfway in her tank, where I'm like, oh, look it. I'm on E. I bet I can make it 37 miles.
Exactly. It says I've got 38. I can do
right,
37 and
exactly.
a half.
Exactly. No, I have run out of gas multiple times. And honestly, most of the time, it's just because I'm not paying attention. Like, I'm so focused on whatever I'm doing or wherever I'm going. And
not driving.
Yeah. And my last car, for whatever reason, it was like three times I ran out of gas in that car. That gas thing would ding, and it was like the car would die. So it's like I became like Pavlov's dog. Like it would ding, and I'd start shaking. Like, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, get me to a gas station. It was like ridiculous.
Get off the freeway. Yeah. I will say, actually, I did run out of gas one time, but it wasn't my fault.
Were you with somebody?
I was not. It was back.
Sounds like it was your fault.
No, it actually wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so do you remember? So when my sister and I both drove, my sister was a year older than I was. She had a car that I then shared with her for about a month. And she had gotten home, and I got in the car to drive and go somewhere, and I made it like to just outside of our track. And you know, that was like no length at all.
Right.
And the car died. It was out of gas. That is not my fault. I couldn't have gotten to a gas station if I'd wanted to.
Okay. The crazy thing about that story is that you only had to share a car for a month.
Okay.
That's crazy.
Why?
Because we had one green station wagon. With an orange strip down the side.
Oh, I know. That's
to be
how I
shared
learned to drive.
By five people. It was like a beat down. No, it's my turn. No, it's my turn. Like, the most physical violence happened. Well, that's actually not true.
Yeah,
there was a
say.
Lot of other fights yes. that happened among my siblings.
But
to this day, we are great friends. We fought a lot when we were young. Like, total knock down, drag out Gen X fighting. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it was brutal. Oh,
but
my God.
But it would also piss her family, or what also pissed one of her brothers off, is Kathy would let me drive the car and not him.
Right.
And it was when we were underage, granted, but when we were the same age.
In fact, speaking of Gen X fighting, and this is a side note, and we will then move back to the story, but there is like a famous picture. My sister and I, every other year, we'd wind up on the same soccer team just because of our ages, even though she was younger than me. There is a picture that my dad took, and she is so angry at me. I don't know what I did, but I'm 100% certain I deserve this. She has my hair just clutched in her hands.
In the team picture?
It's in our soccer uniforms.
Okay. But like, it wasn't like a team picture.
No,
it was-
I was probably... God, I'm guessing I was 14 and maybe she was 12. And she looks like she is trying to tear my hair out. I should post that on Instagram.
You should.
Oh my God, that's what we're going to do. For our listeners, everybody else will have no context. But for people who are listening, they'll see the Instagram and go, oh, that's the one she was talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure I deserved it. Okay, now back to the story.
Okay. In the wake of this terror, one of the things they did, Kathy, is they held a Reclaim the Night march. And this is something that originated in Leeds, which is about 2 hours away, 10 years prior. And it was after the Yorkshire Ripper had gone through their town. And it scared everybody, obviously. This was a serial killer who, in the 70s and 80s, killed 13 women and attempted to kill 7 more. So this was something that just had shut Leeds down, and so they did this Reclaim the Night March. So they held a similar march in Birkenhead because the women had been told, just stay indoors. And, you know, that's not an acceptable answer when there's fear. You don't combat fear by locking yourself behind closed doors.
The day after Diane's murder, there were people who saw a fire in nearby Bidston Hill. And this is an area that's primarily of public land. This fire was not on a residential property. And the eyewitnesses told police that they saw a man running from this area that looked like somebody they knew named Pete. When the detectives brought this couple in who had seen the man running from the fire, they brought him in for a lineup, which, by the way, in England, they call a, what is it, identity parade, which makes it even sound like fun, you know?
I know.
Like, I went to an identity parade today.
I think we need to start renaming that. Let's normalize it.
But anyway, they brought them in for a lineup and they couldn't identify anyone in the lineup. So at one point, detectives were so exasperated, they considered interviewing every man in Birkenhead. And they wound up interviewing, I want to say, 3,000 people.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, there was so much outrage and there was so much terror as a result of poor Diane's murder.
And what does this remind us of?
Well, I don't know. We've done so many cases. What are you thinking of?
Colin Pitchfork.
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes. The police in the Colin Pitchfork case. And I wish I had what number episode that was, sent a letter to all the men between, you know, certain ages in the area surrounding where these poor girls were murdered and asked people to come in voluntarily and give blood samples, which hundreds of men did. And when you read the newspapers at the time about that one, it was like, I came in because my wife was telling me to. But it was more like, oh, I came in because my wife was telling me. Actually, I can't do that. That's a terrible accident.
That accident was an accident. It was a train wreck.
Yeah, exactly. But once the BBC Crime Watch show came out, many, many more leads poured in about the Bidston Hill fire. People were like, oh, I saw it, but I didn't see anybody running, you know, that kind of stuff. However, the descriptions of the people who came forward prompted police to actually go back to the person named Pete, because the original people who reported the fire said it looked like the man they knew, Pete.
And it never explained why they weren't able to identify this guy, Pete, because he actually had been part of that identity parade.
So he was part of a lineup that included a bunch of others, and the eyewitnesses still couldn't pick out their buddy, Pete.
These two original eyewitnesses.
Actually, it's not their buddy, but
right. It was just somebody they knew around town, but
they didn't point to him.
Correct. On September 23rd, 1986, more than 6 weeks after Diane Sindel's murder, detectives brought in 29-year-old Peter Sullivan for questioning. He was an unemployed laborer from Birkenhead, and according to detectives, while they were talking to him, he gave several different versions of events as to what he was doing on the night that Diane was killed. So, after many hours of interrogation, Peter broke down crying and confessed that he, in fact, was the person who murdered Diane Sindel. Then he withdrew the confession and then made the confession again. But he had not been able to speak with a solicitor, and so he was finally allowed to speak with one 2 days after this, and when he did, he then withdrew his confession again.
So when you say 2 days, was he in custody during those 2 days?
Yes. It was over the span of 4 days, but it wasn't a four-day-long interrogation.
It was a two-day interrogation.
Yeah. After he redacted his confession, he just said to police, I made it up. Like, this is hard. I don't want to be here. One of the things that they said about Peter was that he had learning disabilities and he was, I think the phrase they used was, highly suggestible.
I read the same thing as well. And I also watched a documentary and they had an interview of his father. They were quoting the father. It wasn't the father being interviewed back then. But the dad said, he is the type that doesn't stand up for himself. He's not confrontational. If people confront him, he walks away. And so was described as very passive by his family and very like wants to get along, doesn't like any kind of kerfuffles,
right.
You know, very much unlike what this person had to be to murder Diane.
So this police interrogation had to have been very difficult for him.
Oh, totally agree.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
So trial began less than a year later in 1987. The Crown prosecutors told the jury about how Peter happened upon Diane Sindel on the night that her car ran out of gas and she went looking for a gas station. They said that he struck her with a crowbar and then dragged her into the alleyway. Now, the crowbar was a new addition from what I saw because nothing in the newspapers reported what the weapon was until this trial took place.
Right. My understanding, it wasn't specifically identified.
Exactly. And then it talked about him sexually assaulting her, and the attack was referred to as being frenzied. And then, of course, the jury was told about his confession. They said that Peter initially denied his involvement and provided an alibi, and then later he gave the confession, but told detectives that he couldn't remember what really happened because he'd been really drunk at the time. The other thing that came out, Kath, is that there was testimony from a dental expert that Peter's bite exactly matched a bite on Diane's body. The defense countered with what we have just talked about, that he had learning disabilities and he was highly suggestible and apparently very averse to confrontation when he confessed to the police. But Kath, it was also revealed at trial through the defense that the reason that Peter hadn't been given a solicitor for 2 days is that the detectives felt that adding a solicitor might be a hindrance in their interrogation of Peter.
Maybe. A little bit. Maybe just a scotch.
But it tells me they really don't have Miranda rights in England.
They don't. They do admonitions. They do admonitions. Yeah. But it's obviously...
But it's not the same.
Obviously, it's Miranda versus Arizona. It's our Miranda.
After 9 hours of deliberation, Peter Sullivan was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. But what that meant is he was required to serve a minimum of 16 years. And then he'd be eligible for release. And then, Kathy, this is so sad. BBC Northwest Tonight reported how when he was pronounced guilty, Peter just stood in the courtroom silently. His mother broke down and screamed, and his sister actually fainted.
And Kath, I read somewhere that his mother was so appalled. And she said that Peter was looking forward to the trial because he knew then he would be found innocent and be able to go home. And one of the things his mom said was that he had everything. He had a wife that he never thought he'd have and a child, a little boy, I believe, at the time.
It was.
And so her whole point was never in a million years would he have done this kind of thing.
You know, the other thing, Kathy, that I saw, and again, this is 1987, but it's still in the newspapers today, that once he was convicted, all of the newspapers now gave him a new moniker, actually one of two. He was referred to as the Beast of Birkenhead or the Mersey Ripper.
So because Peter Sullivan was sentenced to a minimum of 16 years, he was eligible for parole in 2003, which he applied for. However, at his parole review hearing, he absolutely professed his innocence, and that's not what parole boards want to hear. So that was 2003. Fast forward to 2008. This is 21 years into his sentence. Peter applied to the Criminal Cases Review Commission for assistance. And Kath, as I understand it, this is a public entity in England, and you can apply to them if you believe your case involves a miscarriage of justice. And they actually have subpoena powers, they have authority to interview witnesses, they have authority to obtain police records, medical records, all this kind of stuff that goes along with an investigation. And if they believe they have new evidence or something nefarious happened initially, they can send your case up to the Court of Appeal and say, please hear this again.
You can still appeal to the Court of Appeals in England.
Right.
But of course, obviously having this statutory body behind you saying, oh, we think we found stuff too, definitely helps your case.
Exactly.
Doesn't mean you'll get it, but right. It helps your case.
And they can also, review expert witness testimony, and they could look at whether these same tests apply today, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a board with a lot of juice. So Peter specifically asked them in 2008, could you please look into the DNA evidence? We have, you know, all of these miraculous scientific advances, and my case should be part of that. And the CCRC basically said no. They were told by forensic experts that it would be unlikely that there would be sufficient DNA to find anything of note.
The other thing that I read, Kath, is that even though in 2008, they were obviously far and beyond what DNA testing started out as being, but they were also afraid that there wasn't enough for them to test. And if there was, they would diminish the entire sample only to find out there wasn't enough to attest, something like that.
Okay. So Peter's application was rejected by the CCRC. Now in 2019, this is 32 years into his sentence, twice the minimum that the judge had ordered him to serve. He goes back to the Court of Appeals and he asks them for two things. He asks them to look at the reliability of the disputed bite marks being consistent with his teeth. And he also wanted them to look at his intelligence and suggestibility and really kind of like Monday morning quarterback the confession that he gave to the police because he was saying it was under duress.
And without his solicitor that they had refused to grant him for several days. The other thing, Kath, as I was reading, is that in 2019, so we had said the bite mark was something, of course, they came at him in the first trial and was like, it is identical to Peter's teeth. By this time, in courts across the world, there was a lot of suspicion on bite mark identity because people can have the same teeth. They can have the same structure.
But it's also the difficulty of taking an impression.
Right.
Exactly. And the thing is, in his initial trial, that's what the prosecution said. This is the same as a unique fingerprint. And by 2019, a lot of courts were like, you know what? We're not sure this is really scientific. We're not sure this actually meets the test of reliability.
Right.
So the Court of Appeals took more than 2 years to review Peter's case, but they concluded that it was untimely made and his application could not undermine the totality of the evidence that the prosecution presented to convict him. Once the Court of Appeal rejected his application, his attorney, Sarah Myatt, again went back to the CCRC and said, help us out. We are in 2021. We want this case re-examined in light of all the scientific advances that have been made. She again raised concerns about the bite marks. She also raised concerns about the police interrogation, you know, taking away his will, essentially. And she again requested that the DNA be tested because here we are in 2021 and it had not been tested ever. In the background, what was happening with the Criminal Courts Review Commission is that they had been highly criticized. I think there were two recent cases where DNA exonerated people and those individuals had to fight like hell to get the DNA retested. So now here comes Peter in a very highly publicized case with an attorney asking for DNA testing. And they were like, here you go, ma'am.
Right.
What else do you want?
Can we bring you some coffee while you're waiting?
Exactly.
Perhaps a sandwich. Yeah.
You look hungry.
Yeah, exactly.
They knew that they had to take the semen samples found on Diane Sindel's stomach and test them. DNA testing revealed a male profile that was not consistent with Peter Sullivan. It was also not consistent with any of Diane's relatives or her fiancé that she was engaged to in 1986.
Peter Sullivan's case was overturned by the Court of Appeals on May 13th, 2025, so just a couple of months ago. And they also ordered him to be immediately released from prison. When he was released, he had served more than 38 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. And Kathy, at the age of 68, he was believed to be the victim of the longest miscarriage of justice by a living person in British legal history. The only miscarriage of justice believed to have been longer than Peter Sullivan's 38 years happened to a prisoner named Derek Bentley, who in 1952 was convicted of murder. With DNA evidence, his case was actually overturned in 1998, so 46 years after his conviction. Tragically, though, he was actually hanged for his crime in 1953, just a year after he'd been convicted.
Kath, do you know in that situation, did his family petition and petition and petition to have the DNA reviewed?
I have to believe that's the case, because why else would they?
Right. I would want my loved one's DNA reviewed. You know what I mean?
Oh, like absolutely. If knowing they were innocent, you don't want them in history.
And hanged, yeah.
And you don't want them in history to be known as this
correct
person.
That's what I thought about, actually, with Peter. You know, you have a guy with, you know, learning disabilities. He's a gullible person, and he has to live with these names attached to him.
Right.
Like the Ripper and, you know, I mean, just...
Even in the newspapers, after he was released, after having the case overturned, they referred to the Beast of Birkenhead has had his case overturned. According to reporting by the BBC, Peter Sullivan took part in this hearing via a video link. And when he was told that his conviction was being overturned, he apparently put his hand over his heart and started sobbing. A statement was read by his lawyer, Sarah Myatt, on his behalf. And it said, "What happened to me was very wrong, but it does not detract or minimize that all of this happened off the back of a heinous and brutal loss of life. I am not angry. I am not bitter. I am simply anxious to return to my loved ones and family, as I've got to make the most of what is left of the existence I am granted in this world." Kathy, also speaking after the hearing was Peter's sister, Kim. Now, I have to tell you, I was so happy to see this because, as we said, he's a little slow, highly suggestible and whatnot. And if you've been in prison for 38 years, especially knowing you're innocent this entire time, how do you get released and just be normal?
Right.
And the answer is you don't. But his sister Kim was there and she was talking and she expressed her sympathy for Diane Sindel's family. And despite the fact they got Peter back, nobody won. Like
right.
This is not a win for anyone. She said, "They've lost their daughter. They are not going to get her back. We've got Peter back and now we've got to try and build a life around him again. It's such a shame this had to happen in the first place." So I was just glad to know he has a safe landing spot.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you could tell there's a lot of people who are always pushing for his innocence.
Right,
you
and know? Never lost their belief.
Yeah, no, thank God. So Merseyside police have reopened their investigation, obviously, in light of the verdict being overturned. And they submitted the new DNA through the database and came up with nothing. So this was
their nationwide database.
Yes.
This was all of the UK.
Correct. And they also sent letters to people who were identified in the original investigation in 1986 and said, "Hey, can you please come forward? We'd love to eliminate you as a suspect. Will you donate your DNA?" And there were announcements by the police basically saying, "We're taking this seriously. We are not giving up." So if you were around back then in 1986 and you had suspicions about someone or, you know, something unusual happened that you remember, come forward and talk to us. It doesn't matter if these people are dead because we can always do familial DNA.
Right.
Even though the person is deceased, it doesn't matter. And understandably, there is now a renewed concern in Merseyside because a killer has been roaming and unpunished for nearly 40 years. I don't know what kind of crimes have to be committed to be placed into their DNA database. I don't know if it's any felony. I don't know if it has to be murder. I'm not sure, you know, what their database consists of. But for this DNA not to be in any database, like, this guy flew under the radar. In Birkenhead, fresh flowers and small notes are still left at a small black granite memorial for Diane Sindel in front of the alleyway where she was found on Brewer Road. At the top of the memorial is her name and date of death. Directly below that, it says, "Because she was a woman." Below that it says, in memory of all of our sisters who have been raped and murdered, we will never let it be forgotten. So,
thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Please subscribe. Please tell all your friends to subscribe. And if you have case suggestions, which we've actually just got a few of them in, we'd love to hear them.
What she said.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.